You are listening to the cycling podcast at the Tour de France in association with Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004. Today we are in Nuit Saint-Georges.
Where are we, Lionel?
Where are we? We're at our hotel, Le Gentilhommerie. Is that right, Francois?
La Gentilhommière, I think it's called, but...
Oh, absolutely mangled it. Absolutely mangled it. Can we start again?
No.
Okay.
We're committed now.
It's beautiful, isn't it? We're outside. This is the best hotel of the tour so far by a long way.
And we know it. We knew it before we even came here, didn't we?
We did.
Which is kind of good and bad. This is like climbing a huge mountain, reaching the top, and it's just downhill from here.
And we're
but
only
less
just,
fun than going downhill on a bike.
And we're only just outside Nuit Saint-Georges, where the stage finished this afternoon. We're sat next to the swimming pool, not actually round the swimming pool. That would
not
be too
in
much
the swimming pool yet.
But Francois's got his trunks on already.
Well, I got a bit concerned when I was in my hotel room and I saw Francois march. We haven't recorded yet, obviously, and I saw him march past looking purposeful with his towel tucked under his arm and his swimming trunks on. Priorities, Francois.
So we've got to wrap this up pretty quickly.
I think
so
he's got his priorities right, actually.
We're all going to talk very fast and get the podcast finished so Francois can have a swim before dinner.
Tale of the attack, please, Lionel.
Absolutely. Well, it was stage 7 of the Tour de France. This morning, we were in...
France.
Well, we were in Troyes, weren't we? The home of Andouillette. And we've come to Nuit Saint-Georges, the home of some very fine Burgundy wine. 213.5 kilometres, fairly formulaic stage. Again, the breakaway featured familiar jerseys, Maxime Bouet of Fortunao Oscaro, Manuele Mori of UAE Team Emirates, Johan Gen of Direct Energy, and Dylan Van Baarle of Cannondale. And with it being such a long stage, you might have expected the break to be given perhaps a little bit more of an advantage than they got, but they were only allowed 3:40, so there was never any chance of them staying away to the finish. And then we had really quite an extraordinary sprint, one of the closest I've ever seen. I've never seen a sprint that close. If you look at the photo finish picture that they showed on television, there's really no splitting them. Officially, the gap was 6 millimetres, according to Tissot Timing. They've looked at some super-duper images and come up with...
Is that a technical term?
Super-duper images, yeah. Well, there was a bit of mystery after the finish about exactly how this is done, but Rolf Aldag of Dimension Data, the team of Edvald Bosenhagen, who finished second, was satisfied by the picture that he had seen, so there's no controversy or conspiracy here. Marcel Kittel, the German, was given the verdict.
You had an elaborate conspiracy theory, Lionel.
We'll come on to that in a moment. We'll just update on what's happened. Kittel's won the stage, his 12th of his career, the third of this tour. He's equaled Eric Zabel's record for a German rider. Bosenhagen second by the narrowest of margins. Michael Matthews third, Alexander Kristoff fourth, John Degenkolb fifth. Arno Demar only 11th, not a great result for Demar, so he lost the green jersey to Kittel. Overall, no change. Chris Froome still 12 seconds ahead of his teammate Geraint Thomas, Fabio Aru still in polka dots, and Simon Yates in white. And tomorrow there's climbing to Station de Rousse in the Jura.
I was surprised to mention Simon Yates there. At one point I thought he was going for the sprint. The Orica train was in full flight at the front. Simon Yates tucked in at the end of a string of 5 or 6 riders. It looked like he was being set up for the sprint, which would have been remarkable.
If it had been 6 millimetres between Marcel Kittel and Simon Yates, that would have been quite extraordinary, wouldn't it? But I think Bosenhagen being up there on a flat finish like that, yes, he is a good sprinter, but he's more suited to the rolling stages.
But he's been doing it differently, hasn't he? Yesterday and today, he's gone very long, very, very long yesterday, about 300, 350 metres yesterday, I think. But today, again, he took it on very early and almost caught Kittel out.
Which raises a question, and it's just, I don't have the answer, I just raised the question. If Dimension Data need a sprinter, why use Eddy Boissonhagen? I mean, I like the guy, he's a great rider, but I have the impression that Mark Renshaw and even Bernie Eisel are probably faster than he is. So you know, it's always the that old question that when you're a lead out man, are you able to be a sprinter in your own right, or do you really have to work for somebody else? In this case, I'm sure if you put them on track, Mark Renshaw and Edouard Boissonnaggen, or even probably Bernie Eisenhower, is a little bit old now, but I'm not sure Boissonnaggen would win in a sprint on track.
But he's a very strong rider, isn't he? I mean, I know a problem that Team Sky had with him was, you know, when he was part of that Tour de France team in 2012 in particular, he really wanted to go for finishes himself. Maybe not so much 2012, but other years, certainly. He was really keen to get involved where the team was dedicated to GC. In 2012, of course, they had Mark Cavendish on the team.
That's right.
And there was one stage in particular that Boissonnaggen effectively won for Cavendish.
Yeah. Well, what I mean by that is that some guys have that mentality of winning. Mark Renshaw, when he was with Rabobank, when he left Mark Cavendish and he was no longer the leader man for Cavendish, he decided to have a run for himself, and it didn't work. He's a fast rider, but he was always beaten in sprints, actually. So it's funny to see that guys like Bernie Eisenhower or Mark Renshaw that are potentially faster than a guy like Boissonnaggen, they're not used as sprinters because they don't have that knack. They don't have this real urge to win that probably Boissonnaggen has.
Grinta. We actually had a message, Francois. I'm sorry to do this to you in the podcast, because who am I to correct your linguistic skills? But we had a message from Fran Reyes, friend of the podcast, Fran Reyes, Spanish journalist, who said, just a quick note for Francois, we don't say grinta in Spanish, it is an Italian word. I think you said that the other day. Sorry.
There's so much for me. Yeah, okay.
Well, Francois has had six perfect days on the podcast, but, you know, with our penchant for pointing out everybody's mistakes in a nitpicky way.
With Daniel not here, somebody has to do it. Listen, one thing as well, just for the avoidance of any doubt, the water challenge the other day was absolutely, there was absolutely no rigging or there's no conspiracy theory there, like Lionel's conspiracy theory about today's stage. That it was absolutely a fair challenge. Francois had no idea what waters he was drinking. It was taste buds alone. What was his conspiracy theory again?
It was very light-hearted. As we were walking back from the buses, Rich, I was, you know, looking at the story from every possible angle. And there was this, when the Peter Sagan, Mark Cavendish controversy was raging about whether Sagan should have been sent home, people were asking whether Dimension Data's position as one of the Tour's partners would have had any bearing on the decision to disqualify Sagan. Now, almost, well, not no, because the decision...
Also, why is it in Dimension Data's interest to send Sagan home?
Well, it's not, but quite apart from the fact it wasn't an ASO decision, it was a UCI commissaire decision, and, you know, while those two bodies do talk to one another, I would be very surprised if there was any pressure.
So it was the wrong decision, but not for that reason.
It was the wrong decision, but not for that reason. But today, with the very close sprint finish, I was thinking, well, maybe, you know, to put aside any suspicion that Dimension Data have been favoured in this very close photo finish that none of us have been able to see, perhaps there's been a double switcheroo and they fixed it in favour of Quickstep.
in order to avoid the accusation that it's fixed, in order to avoid the accusation of it being fixed.
Absolutely.
Can I have an even more wicked conspiracy theory? You know, they did it on purpose to have such a close finish so that Dimension Data could come up with these nice pictures and show how good they are, you know, telling the winner from the second place.
But we're not the conspiracy theory podcast, are we? We're the cycling podcast. And we were down at the finish line and in amongst the team buses. We caught a few words from Edvald Boissonnaggen, who didn't win the stage but came very, very close. So let's hear.
Here he is.
About the photo, it was it was really close, and I didn't really know. Yeah, the team did really well. They took me all the way to the line, and I sprinted. There was a really good lead out, and ran in the last meters there. That was really, really good. Of course, I'm happy with it, but I would like to win, of course, but I was really close on the line there, and I'm really happy with what a team was leading me out. They did a really good job, so it's pity I didn't make it all the way to the line.
But this gives you confidence for the next chances in the sprint?
Yeah, it does. I'm not a sprinter actually, so for these flat stages, so I'm really happy to be up there, and so that's really good.
That was Edvald Boasenhagen, always very mild-mannered, isn't he? I mean, Francois was talking about that grinta, that little extra, that sort of killer instinct that you need to win. And I don't want to sound like I'm being harsh, because I think Edvald Boasenhagen is a very nice guy who's very popular. He didn't seem that annoyed to have lost the stage by so little, which
surprised
me. No, he
was smiling and
he was very,
looking
he said,
quite
oh, second's quite good.
Yeah, I mean, well, and also Marcel Kittel had that thrust of aggression over the line, didn't he? And Edvald Boasenhagen didn't, and that was what the difference was, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, Kittel, when he's when he's launched at such a speed and with the power, I mean, De Mar yesterday was saying, we were talking about his blue wing flying past, and today De Mar again said, with the bulk he has, it's like kind of a bullet, and you can hear the noise, you can feel the power, you can feel the strength of this guy, and obviously that made a difference, and it made such a difference. Then this year, three sprint wins in the Tour is quite impressive. He's heading to, I don't see why he should lose the other up and coming sprints in the next couple of weeks. Maybe the mountains will affect him a little bit, but this superiority is such. They're really, we know that Greipel always wins one, so he will win one, probably, which one we don't know. But, Kittel could easily win two more, or maybe three more, and could really, have a kind of a grand slam of sprint wins on this tour. I mean, I really can't see anybody really challenging Kittel. Demar won. One, but we saw he was a very very contentious sprint. So far, I really can't see any opposition for Kittel. Let's face it,
scoring a lot of points for my fancy team.
Well, that's the most important thing.
He's propping it up at the moment.
Before we talk a bit more about Kittel, also down at the finish line, it was a special day for Boasenhagen because his parents arrived this afternoon. Signe Boasen, his mum, and Odd Erik Hagen, his dad, Yeah, it's 6 years to the day that Boasenhagen won his first Tour de France stage in Lisieux. That was on July the 7th, 2011, when he was riding for Team Sky. But I had a quick chat with Edvald Boasenhagen's mum, Signe.
We have just arrived. We got from Norway this morning, so we came 20 minutes before the line. So. Well,
did you think he'd won it, maybe?
I hoped. It's this day in 2011 he won last time. So,
is that why you chose to come today on the no, sixth anniversary?
Not really, but I said to Edvald last evening and sent him a picture from my diary, and where he won in 2011, and. I will try, he said.
I'm sorry the result didn't go your way today, but maybe another day in the Tour will be Edvald's day.
It was so close.
It was more than so close. Yes. I mean, I don't know how they told the difference in the photo.
No, there was nearly no difference. Well, but next time.
Hi, I'm Reese, the head barista in the Rafa Clubhouse in Copenhagen, and you are listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa.
The Rafa Cycling Club is the largest global community of its kind. Members share their passion for the road through rides, events, exclusive club kit and racing. Find out more at rafa.cc.
Thank you very much indeed to Rafa for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. And we have our first Pedaleur de Charme of this Tour de France. The poll opened a day ago. Voting was open for 23 hours and the winner was, drumroll, Taylor Finney. Quite a convincing victory, actually, for Taylor Finney. So I will go and present him with a T-shirt. Maybe not tomorrow, but the day after. But he got 58% of 1,180 votes. Guillaume Van Kiersbroek was second. Johan Fredo was third, and Tish Benoit was fourth. His bottle giving to a child, not enough, clearly, to impress our listeners.
Well, Taylor Finney is the dictionary definition of charming peddling, isn't he, when you Taylor watch Finney, him in action?
I mean, if Taylor Finney ended his career without a Peddler de Charme t-shirt, something would have gone wrong.
Yeah.
And so I just hope that the small, beautifully made and designed t-shirts that we have from Rafa, I just hope it fits him okay. But we'll see. And all we require him to do is hold it up in front of the camera. what he does with it thereafter is his business. So so I'll go and present Taylor Finney with his Peddler de Charme t-shirt in the next 48 hours. So, listen, the other thing to talk about from today was, I think, Quick Step and Marcel Kittel's win. At the finish, you spoke to Brian Holm, didn't you, Lionel?
Yep.
Will we hear from him?
Let's hear from Brian Holm, the sports director. Well, that was close, Brian.
Oh, yeah, well, sort of. But, you know, if you win with, like, two, three bikes, it's going to get boring. So we have to entertain the people, and so he did.
So what was the gap in the end, do you know? 1 millimetre? Two?
Ah, well, what I heard was about 1.2 millimetres. So, but he said everything was under control, so it was fine.
Marcel said everything was under control. He knew, did he?
Oh, that was this morning. I didn't see him after the stage, so it was always getting a bit too exciting, because when I saw it on the TV screen, I thought he won. Then the bloody mechanic convinced me he was second. I was so disappointed, and afterwards we heard he was one again. But like, we're seeing a win, get disappointed, and then you hear a win, it's just not the same. So I like the first win a bit more than today.
Bosan Hagen did well. I mean, you know him. Did you think he has that kind of sprint in him on the flat like that? I didn't think that would be his finish, really.
Actually, we see sometimes. I mean, when they got sort of a good team, and we saw it before, like Kev dropping out, you know, the second one in the row is stepping up. And so maybe Kev spoiled his chances in the past, because he was all riding for Kev. But I worked quite a few years with Ewald, and he's a damn good cyclist, and I'm happy I didn't win today.
So pulling my leg a little bit there, that it was intentional that Quickstep wanted a very exciting close finish. I'm sure they would have preferred a 3-4 bike length win, but it wasn't to be. But three stage wins and, you know, very impressive sprinting. He's done it in three very different ways already, hasn't he? Today, you know, I've been keeping an eye on the sprint trains. Today was certainly the most formed conventional kind of, or recent convention type sprint train that I've seen in the final with Quickstep today. They had three guys still there into the last sort of couple of kilometres. And, you know, there wasn't a great deal of challenge from other teams at that point. But then it all went messy again. And that advantage that they looked like they had was allowed to slip away, and that was possibly I'm not quite sure why that was. I think it's just because people were opening the sprint a lot earlier than they might have expected. Like Rich, you mentioned Bosan Hagen going for a long one. He was by no means the first guy to start sensing the line was coming.
Actually, Marcel Kittel talked about it this morning and talked about it again tonight, saying that he compared to the stage wins he had in 2013 and 2014, saying that in the old days it was simple for him to win. You know, the train was running, and the last wagon to be delivered home was him. It doesn't happen like this anymore. And he was saying, I don't know why that is. He said that probably in the old days you had two or three trains, very efficient trains, but these days you have six, seven, eight, nine trains. And he was saying, he used the word, he said, that these trains are probably neutralizing each other, which means that actually in and sometimes there was also, he was saying, probably attacking a little bit too early. That's what the FDJ train did today. And so he said the result of it is that we're kind of sprinting alone. And we find ourselves that the sprinters in the last the last 500 meters on our own, which is very unusual. So actually in the train, the trains are doing their jobs. And as we saw yesterday, they start their job actually from the start, because you have these guys taking over the duties for the old stage. And then, but possibly what has been missing in the train in the trains this last couple of stages is the lead out man, the last, you know, the launcher, the launch pad. I mean, that's disappeared in the tour now. Maybe there are, you know, reasons for that. Guys were injured, guys were involved in crashes, or you know, trains were probably dismantled a little bit with the crashes. But the, in any case, they're all struggling to add, to tell you why. And today he was saying that he was not surprised that Boston Icon became second, because actually the Dimension Data train went into action just at the right time, which you know, is becoming very important.
Well, I mean, Reinhard Janse van Rensburg, the South African champion, did a fantastic turn for Boston Hagen. That was really the point where Quickstep lost control of things. You always notice when a national champion jersey is doing something. So, you know, but that was a noticeable effort from van Rensburg there. And, you know, that gave Boston Hagen the springboard to almost win the stage.
You don't always notice a national champions jersey doing something, because we should mention Team Sunweb, who have a very anonymous national champions jersey in Sinkeldam, the Dutch champion. But we should mention them, because they did a very good job today as well. And Michael Matthews was third, but they were very prominent towards the end as well. Returning to Quickstep, there were two big team bosses, big cheeses, who arrived today. For my first sighting of both of them, coincidentally, as we arrived to very nice wine country. Jonathan Vauters was one of them.
That's an absolute coincidence. There's no correlation between Jonathan Vauters arriving in the heart of Burgundy wine production.
And Patrick Lefebvre was the other one.
Who also likes nice wine, doesn't
yeah,
he?
Exactly. There has been, of course, great uncertainty over the future of Quickstep. None of the riders have signed up beyond this year, although it has been reported that Philippe Gilbert has signed a contract extension. But great uncertainty over the team. There was a report in the Belgian media last week that the team's future was assured and secured, and Patrick Lefebvre reacted very angrily to that, one suspects, because they will make a formal announcement at some point, perhaps during the tour, which they have done in the past. Anyway, I spoke to Patrick Lefebvre at the finish a little bit about Marcel Kittel, Dan Martin, who's their GC hope, and the future of the team.
Patrick, you've got Marcel Kittel dominating the sprints and Dan Martin up there as well. You must be enjoying this tour.
Yes, I was looking a little bit not for us to come to the tour. It's like a heavy thing. It's my 35th, but there's one thing I never will leave at home, my will to win with the team.
And obviously Kittel has won a few stages now. What can we expect, do you think, from Dan Martin?
Well, I think Dan is very confident about his shape, about his condition. He was working very hard for months to have this goal, and until now everything goes okay.
Well, the Tour de France is the one thing that has eluded you. I mean, could you have a Tour winner this year?
Well, it's too early to say those things, of course. We're not a favorite, but we're looking like we're doing with Marcel, die by die, and when he can surprise one of the bigs one day, why not?
And will we have any news during the tour about the future of the team?
I hope I can do this during the tour, yes.
You confident?
I'm always confident, but I'm also realistic. I'm a bookkeeper.
So, it's been claimed that the team is guaranteed a future. Is that not quite the case yet? Are we still waiting for confirmation of that?
Yeah, you ask me this every day. I wish I could say yes, it's all okay, but for me it's okay when it's signed.
I asked Patrick Lefebvre there about Dan Martin's chances in the race, and the Tour de France is the one race that he's never won as a team boss in all his years in charge. It's the title that has eluded him. I don't necessarily think that Dan Martin can win this tour. However, on the evidence so far, he is clearly in the form of his life, and he's ridden extremely well.
Yeah, he's had a bad time with signing GC riders, hasn't he? Over the years, who have they had? I mean, they put a lot of money into a Spanish guy who showed a lot of press promise, Pecho Roman. I remember he was being talked of as the next big thing. Then there was the Venezuelan rider, whose name escapes me, but had done very well in the Giro, and they piled a lot of money into him. And really,
they even tried Rigoberto Urán.
They did, yeah. Mm. And it, that didn't work out for him.
No.
Terribly
well.
Well,
I mean, second in the Giro, wasn't he, at Quickstep?
but he didn't win it. That's the thing.
And nowhere in the Tour de France. But no. Dan Martin, you know, he's a very good bet for the top five, the way things are looking at the moment.
He'll be in the top five, I'm sure.
When you look at the course and you look at the way he's... can climb and the types of climbs, they're not the conventional, you know, 18 kilometer grind from bottom to top, which is where he tends to, because it doesn't look like a terribly efficient climbing style. It's obviously very effective, but effective on the, you know, the shorter or the climbs that where the gradient changes a bit and he can use his head as much as his legs. When it's just a long grind and he gets into that kind of nodding motion, you know, that's when he's putting an awful lot of movement into his upper body, but seems to be going backwards when the really fast guys start riding away from him. But looking on this course, the only undoing for him I can see is the time trial in Marseille, and even that isn't too bad for him because of the climb that's in the middle.
Is a changing rider. I mean, when it was with Cannondale whatever the name of the team was at the time. He won Liège, as we know. He was that type of rider. Well, he showed the other day in Longwy that it kept that, that feeling for these short final climbs, and he still had this push, you know. But he's improved. Last year, I think it took him time to make the transition from a great rider who can win classics, especially if they're very hilly, or maybe can win a great Grand Tour stage in the mountains, but only one stage. To make this transition to a Grand Tour leader and a GC contender is difficult. He changed teams to achieve that. He moved to Andorra. There was lots of changes in his life and his career, and that's why last year you could tell he was very, very nervous about it, very fidgety. He's always been one of the nicest guys in the peloton, and last year you could tell he was not so nice with us. I mean, you could feel the nerves and everything around it, and he was skinny, really skinny last year, and is regained a little bit of bulk this season, I found. So I think he's probably found the right balance mentally to adjust to his position, and also the right balance physically for the job. So he's still a very good rider in stages like Longwy, and we'll have to see. But I bet being in Andorra and practicing in these, you know, very, very tall, high altitude climbs, that he's probably got everything required to be in the top five. Evidently, and maybe in the top three.
Well, I remember the my sort of abiding memory of Dan Martin's tour last year was his disappointment after the stage two Luchon, the one where Chris Froome just accelerated over the top of the Perisord, the final climb, and caught everybody by surprise, really, because they thought, well, why is he going now with 150 meters to go to the top? There's only the descent. What's he gonna? No one reacted, did they? And then, of course, he did his frog on a skateboard descending act and won the stage and took the yellow jersey. And Dan Martin, after that stage, was really kicking himself for not seeing that as an opportunity and realizing, I think, that you have to pick days in the Tour to race like they're a classic, not just think, well, I'm going over the 3 weeks, so I don't necessarily want to make a big effort here now. Sometimes you have to take that risk on those key moments. I know he fell away after that, but you just never know, because the Tour is all about, getting into position first and then conserving, because things do calm down in that final week, don't they? Everyone settles into their position. So if he can get through, say, this weekend, still in the top three, four or five, then I think we're on for, seeing a great GC result from Dan Martin.
Perhaps another reason is that Quickstep had far too many good riders in the teams in the past. But then the fact that Julien Alaphilippe is not there or Tony Martin makes a difference, because these guys are not going for stage wins. So you have Kittel in the one hand and you have Dan Martin on the other hand, and nobody in between. Last year, if Alaphilippe had been here, you would have had, they would have gone for stage win. That's the culture of Quickstep, and probably hampered the GC's chances in the past. This time, Kittel has done his job. He's doing it well. He will do it again. Now it's time for Dan Martin to go for a good GC ranking.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport.
Hello, my name is James Morton. I'm the head of nutrition for Team Sky. I'm also a reader in exercise metabolism at Liverpool John Moores University. And last but not least, the world-class knowledge director for Science in Sport. I think the role of protein really is we're gaining increased knowledge with every year what protein can do in the body, especially to muscle recovery and muscle adaptation. We've just published a study on the Liverpool first team players where we've analysed their dietary intakes over a 2-game week period, and we've seen that the daily protein intakes was around 2.5 grams per kilogram body mass. Now, prior studies of elite football players were done back in the 1980s, early 1990s, and the protein intakes in those days was only between 1 gram to 1.5 grams per kilo. The demands of the game haven't changed that much in 20 years. I think what's happening is athletes and sports scientists are now becoming increasingly aware of the role of protein, and of course driven by commercial companies with protein supplements, and therefore athletes and sports scientists are now adhering to best practice protein intake. But the way to think of it is that protein really just provides the building blocks, and those amino acids that are contained in protein are delivered to your muscles, and effectively they help the muscle rebuild themselves or repair themselves after every single hard training session, and therefore it's just really promoting recovery. It's especially important during times of weight loss, because during times of calorie restriction, what you want to do is to lose fat, but actually to maintain all of the lean muscle tissue that you have. And therefore, in periods of weight loss and calorie restriction, then the first thing that we always change is we ramp up the protein intake.
Hi, I'm Luke Rowe, ride for Team Sky, and straight after a stage, and normally first thing I have is a smoothie, which is kind of a recovery drink. Then it'll be some pasta and some kind of protein portion, so whether it's chicken, fish, or you know, some steak or whatever. But I think the main thing is just a big portion of carbohydrates, so normally pasta, but sometimes rice or quinoa or what have you. You know, if I pass the food room, I might grab a bowl of cereal or a muesli bar or something. It's just kind of eat to feel, really, and eat as much as you can when you can.
Hi, I'm Garen Thomas from Team Sky, and we're fueled by Science and Sport.
So I've got my recovery drink now, which I just finished on turbo, and then got a smoothie in there, which that's more just getting an easier way of getting the carbs in, really, when you don't feel like eating after a hot day. And then shower and stuff, and then on the bus on the way to the hotel, there's rice or potatoes and a bit of fish or meat as well. So fully loaded.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. We just heard there a little mini feature about fueling for recovery after a stage. We heard what Geraint Thomas and Luke Rowe have, and we heard from James Morton, Team Sky nutritionist, who also works for Science in Sport and works with Science in Sport. Speaking of nutrition, none of those riders actually mentioned that their post-stage ritual included Andouillette.
No, I can't think of any surely, good time
surely
of day
the most
to eat
French,
this.
The most French rider, I mean, Romain Bardet must tuck into some Andouillette as opposed. None of these energy bars or protein drinks for him, surely.
Well, I talked to Romain Bardet this morning about wine. We'll hear from that in one of these days in a podcast or in a Kilometer Zero. Actually, he didn't mention Andouillette because if you look at him, he's very skinny and he has his personal dietitian, who's a guy I know, and you know, is really the type of guy you wouldn't go to dinner with, you know, because usually nutritionists, well, some of them, they look like priests or something, you know, they're not actually for the good old dinner with friends, wine, andouillette, and the sort of stuff. That's not actually what the rider's diet. It used to be the rider's diet in the old days, but it's not anymore. So
if Science and Sport are looking for new ambassadors, Francois is available.
I can imagine the andouillette-flavoured energy gel going down a storm.
But in the same time, Romain Bardet was saying that he actually drinks wine on the tour, from not every day, but from time to time, if they celebrate a victory or they're in the wine region. So probably tonight he'll have a nice glass of Burgundy, just one, you know. I was also talking to Serge, the doctor from Team Astana, asking him, is wine good for riders? And he said, yes, one glass from time to time. He said it's full of antioxidants and it's good. and you're realizing I'm trying to avoid the underyard subject.
Well, we were in Troyes last night, the home of the world's most disgusting sausage made of pig's stomach lining, tripe. We ordered it. I possibly gave the misleading impression that I'd ordered it for myself. I couldn't, but I did have a taste, and I'm afraid, Francois, my opinion has not changed all that much. Although yesterday's andouillette, which was a 5A rated, absolutely, world's best andouillette, according to the man at the restaurant,
the guy selling it.
He's the guy selling it, yeah. But you enjoyed your andouillette sausage.
It was good. It was not actually the best andouillette I had in my life. Because one thing to know, and our photographer Simon, who really was a brave man, he ordered it and he ate it all. It's very good with mustard, you know. The problem with andouillette, it's not the taste. The taste is fine. It's just meat, you know, with a little bit of flavor. But I think that's the idea, that it's tripes, and, you know, it's guts. It's sometimes a little bit hard to take for the brain, and in the same time as well, the texture is kind of rubbery. But last night, and when it's done well, it's not that rubbery, and actually, it's not fat. Now, that's the thing. Yeah, the guy at the restaurant was telling us that they actually the andouillette I ate last night was done by hand. The guy is taking the fat away with his hands, like he's, you know, kind of stroking his andouillette, and you know, it's all something. it's really a craft, you know? and to be honest, no, it was good stuff. Not the best andouillette I've ever had. There's a guy in, very strangely enough, in Drancy, that's a horrid place outside of Paris, who's, you know, known for doing the best andouillette in the world, the 5A andouillette, and the andouillettes this guy makes are better than the one I had last night.
Stay tuned for A Kilometre Zero on Food and Wine with Francois. We should mention the Kilometre Zero that came out today. It was Phil Anderson, a story of the Australian pioneer, first non-European to wear the yellow jersey in Tour de France in 1981. So Lionel caught up with him and a few other Australians. Very good listen it was. We take a break from A Kilometre Zero for the weekend.
Well, we give people a chance to catch up if they've missed anything.
If you're off the back, it's a chance to get back on.
And then we go
convoy
again after the rest day on the rest day, Monday morning, there'll be another Kilometre Zero.
Indeed there will. So listen, back to the bike race. You spoke to Lars Back this morning, Francois.
Yeah, because as I was saying yesterday, you have to admire these guys who spend all day, in the front of the bunch. Nobody knows who they are. Sometimes even the best commentators just don't know who they are. They just say, oh, Quickstep are leading, or, oh, Lotto Soudal are leading. These guys have names. They spend like, 200Ks in the front. It's a very hard job they say that it's their job, you know. And without them, there wouldn't be stages like the ones we've seen in the last couple of days. You might find it boring. Imagine what they feel themselves, being taking turns in the front. You know, like there's only three or four of them. Lars Back is one of these guys, and I really wanted to ask him what it felt like, spending so much time in the sun in the lead, and also ask him how do they know what the gap is, how do they know what kind of pace to take to control the breakaway, does it work all the time. And also I wanted to ask him, because obviously he felt a little bit relieved this morning when I talked to him, and I asked him, why do you feel relieved? Because, and he said, well, the mountains are coming, and it means that for once it gets away from the front stage and back into the gruppetto and relaxes a little bit. So, well, that's let's listen to Lars Back.
One of the guys you see the most on camera on the Tour de France.
Is it? Thank you. I'm always so beautiful, no? No, that's why I'm here. That's my job. Like Julian Vermoorde from Quickstep, we have both of us have a good sprinter. So to create a bunch sprint, we need to keep it together every day, and that's one of my job here.
But you need the legs. How are the legs with so many kilometers to go?
The legs are okay. It's more the temperature, I think, that's hard for everybody. I mean, it's not because it was so demanding, the watch we did yesterday, but it's a long day, the heat, and in that way your body gets really, really tired. But it's the same for everybody, and we all had a good sleep, and we are ready for today.
How do you cope with the breakaways up to the time gap? You get information, don't let it go further than 3 minutes. How does it work?
Yeah, of course, you have a feeling how fast you go yourself. You look at your watch, you look at your speed, and then you calculate also, is it five guys in the break, is it three guys, is it eight guys, and how many guys are helping in the bunch, you know, and then the director is giving you information with the times. And sometimes you saw in Dauphiné Libéré, there was two times the break went to the finish, so it's not always you can calculate it. Sometimes the breakaway are smart and strong, and then they cheat us, you know.
And Lars, what's your life like when you get to the mountains then? You've done your job in the flat, and then we'll reach the mountain at the weekend. So what happens to you then?
For me, in the weekend, like when we come to the mountains, it's more like a grand fondo, you know? I mean, it's like, it's physical hard, but I have no really job to do, you know? But in the tour, there's nothing... There's no days where you can just switch off your mind, because otherwise it's going to be too demanding. So you have to always make a goal, even with the mountain states, and then say, okay, I want to still be in the bunch on this mountain and try to drop here and help Andre and get some bottles in the start to the guys that can be in the end of the mountain. I mean, Chis and Tim, you have to help them in the start. But of course, they don't really expect that I'm going to win a mountain stage, the team, of course. And I have to recover, but you can never recover in the tour. I mean, it's you still have to push, and the mountains is not going away over the night. But I take it day by day. If I start thinking about what's coming tomorrow, then like they say in Lotto, we live your dream, you know, every day, and that's what I do.
Are you usually one of the guys who paces the gruppetto, or not really?
It depends. Last year I was one of the weakest guys in the mountains, so I was just hanging on to the gruppetto. 2 years ago I was never in the gruppetto, I was really good uphill. So it depending how shape you are, we are always like, if you are in the gruppetto, you always look for Cavendish, okay, now he's not here, Andre, Kittel, you know, you always stick together, you know, and then you help each other and do a certain good speed, everybody. There's always a good, I mean, we always help each other. There's maybe the only place where you see the sprinter help each other, that's in the gruppetto, because everybody want to come as smooth as possible to the finish, you know. And some days it's just like, for some people it's going to be out of body experience because you're so tired and you know, you push and so it's good to stick together, you know, and help each other, because it's going to be really hard some days.
I love the line from Lars back there, Francois, when he says the mountain stages are like a grand fondo for him. You just the idea, just a casual 180k in the mountain, no big deal. You know, stop at the feed zone maybe, and I like fuel up on pasta at the end.
I also like the line when he says, because we've had all this controversy about sprinters and, you know, 10 sprints and crashes and Sagan and everything. And the line when he says that the mountain is the only time when sprinters are friends again. That's an interesting one.
Well, listen, we should wrap things up perhaps for tonight. We are into the mountains again tomorrow. A couple of interesting stages coming up. If you're missing Kilometer Zero over the next couple of days and you want something else to listen to, by all means, sign up as a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com. £10 for the year. You'll gain access to all kinds of exclusive content, roughly speaking, a monthly show, which this year we've covered, well, Matt Heyman's Paris-Roubaix win in his own words. We've done behind the scenes at the Lotto Soudal training camp.
Lars backs in that.
Our event at he's a snorer, isn't he? Shares with Adam Hansen. Adam Hansen talks
That's
a lot
really
about
interesting story. That
it's an interesting
story. The story of roommates and how they now are regular roommates when, you know, Lars Back was basically the one that no one wanted to share with.
Adam Hansen can deal with it because he spends so much of the night on his computer.
It makes Adam Hansen's performance of 18 Grand Tours in succession even more admirable.
Yeah, I mean, riding his bike during the day, listening to somebody snoring at night. Even more remarkable. What else do we have in the Friends Specials? We've got our event at Dusseldorf and the eve of the tour that was released as a Friends Special.
Yeah, still relevant to listen to now because we were talking on the eve of the tour. You can go through and laugh at all the things we got wrong before the start.
We've got Stephen Roach's story of his 1987 Giro d'Italia win. We've got our Giro 100 program with myself, Lionel, and Daniel Freib. And we've got Daniel's lunch with Linus Gerdemann, also on the eve of the tour.
While we're just plugging things, also, I'm going to say this because our Rafa kit has turned up. The new Rafa Pedaleur de Charme cycling jersey has arrived. I've been eagerly awaiting one of these. I'm going to go for a bike ride tomorrow morning, Rich, and I'm going to wear it for the first time. So I'll let you know how it fits and how it wears. But it looks fantastic. It's a pale blue with a sort of cross detailing on it. The Pedaleur de Charme logo with the comb and the bottle of eau de cologne. And if you want to see one of those and buy one of those, then they are on rafa.cc.
Great. And also through our own website. If you go to the shop on our own website, you will find all the Rafa kit. In the meantime, we'll be back tomorrow. Thank you very much, Francois.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.